The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition for this week. This week is part three in our series where we're walking people through our philosophy and approach to retirement planning. It's what our firm kind of focuses on is retirement planning. And we did a series similar to this a few years ago, but we figured it was time to circle back and kind of refresh everything. There's been a little bit of evolution in the approach and some of the things we do. Wanted to share those things with you. Kind of also let new listeners into the laboratory, if you will, to learn about the secret sauce, how it is we do our projections and look at retirement. And some people in the listening audience try to replicate some of what we do, which we wholeheartedly encourage, and also encourage people to kind of put their own spin on it, whatever's kind of appropriate for your unique circumstances. It's always a good idea to customize things for your circumstances. And also want to remind people we're dedicating this series to Jim's dad, who had quite an influence on him, and through Jim, the firm itself has been influenced, and our approach. Many of the things we talk about can be traced to stories shared by Jim's dad. And Jim's dad passed away a few weeks ago, so we thought we'd dedicate this series to him. So Jim, I'll invite you on. I think what we did is kind of left people, I don't know if we left them hanging, but we went through a walkthrough last time of the minimum dignity floor concept, what that entails, why we find it important to consider as one of the foundational elements of a retirement plan. And then as an extension on that, we encourage people to protect that set of expenses, the minimum dignity floor expenses, with a resource that you can't outlive. And by that, we usually refer to what we call secure income. And we promised people last time that we were going to start talking to them about secure income, how we view it, how we implement it, what's considered secure income, and how one might consider using it to cover things like the minimum dignity floor. So I think that gets us right back to where we left off last time.
I think it does. You did a very good job.
Oh, thank you.
So welcome, everybody, to episode three, I guess, of our process. We've got to come up with a better name than that. But,
well, it's the Secure Retirement Income Process.
The Secure Retirement Income Process. And we're not going to do it today, but we'll share at some point, hopefully, how we came up with that name, a little bit of a funny story behind. I think we've talked about it before on the podcast, but how we came up with the name Secure Retirement Income Process. But Chris is right. This is dedicated to my dad, and hopefully somehow at some level he may be listening. He never listened when he was alive to the show, so I'm not quite sure he can when he's passed, depending on your beliefs of the afterlife or not. But if you are listening, Dad, this is, again, dedicated to you. You cannot talk about minimum dignity floor without also talking about secure income. Secure income is the peanut butter to the minimum dignity floor jelly. You just can't talk about one without the other. They go best together. So last week was all about the MDF. This week, it's going to be all about secure income. We'll give you our definition of secure income. You can do whatever you want for your secure income. It doesn't have to follow our definition to the T. We like our definition and we consider a secure income to be what we consider it to be. But we also will count other sources of income, even if it's not secure. It's just that we address it a little bit differently. And we'll add clarity to all of this as the discussion goes on. But remember conceptually, folks, if you created, especially all you VGs out there, if you pulled out your Excel and you started programming your minimum dignity floor, if you started trying to itemize your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses, if you've applied reasonable rates of inflation tied to those individual expenses, not to the general headline inflation number, you should notice a few things. Your minimum dignity floor should be a graph. Now, we do a bar graph when we put all the data into Excel. We do not use Excel to crunch one number for our clients. We use our planning software. We just take the data from the planning software, get it into Excel, not to crunch it any further, but to visually display it. And I'm going to encourage all you VGs trying to do this on your own. Don't look at column after column after column after column of numbers. Don't. Because if there's an anomaly in there, if there's a mistake, you're not going to see it. It's like a word search, but a really difficult word search. You're not going to see every wrong number. But you visualize those numbers, boom. You can pick up an anomaly a lot quicker. So what we do is we visualize, we break each year of minimum dignity floor expenses out, and we create it as a bar graph. And generally, if you're going to do that, your bar graph should, for most people, look just like I'm about to describe. On the left part of your piece of paper or computer screen or mind, if you're just envisioning this, is where secure income starts. And the first bar, if it was 2024, would be there. But 2025's bar should be a little bit higher. 2026's and 27, 28, 29, 30, they should all be higher. Not constantly. You'll start to see sometimes your minimum dignity floor adjusting a little higher, a little bit lower. When we pick up on that, Chris and his team dive in to try to see what's changed. More often than not, maybe a mortgage payment goes away or a car payment goes away or taxes come into play or something is impacting the MDF. But for the most part, your minimum dignity floor should be in the lower left, moving steadily up to the upper right. Why is this important? You're now going to overlay that bar graph with your projected secure income. Now, we have a different color for all three of our secure income sources. So let's talk about secure income, what it is, and the three sources that we consider to be secure income. We will still account for non-secure income. Don't get me wrong, but let's just concentrate right now on secure income. When I was conceptually coming up with the idea of this, to me, since secure income is vitally important to cover expenses that last the rest of your life, I had a few non-negotiables, if you will, that I wanted in secure income. So I thought to myself, first, secure income should have no ambiguity. I should easily be able to project with a strong degree of accuracy. We may not be on the bullseye, but I want to be on the target. And I want to be on a close ring to the bullseye on the target. I don't want to just nick it at the very, very far end. I kind of want to be solidly on the target. So there should be no ambiguity with secure income. How much you're going to receive at any point in the future can easily be estimated and be accurate in the estimation. Number two, if secure income moves at all, I felt, it can only move up. It doesn't have to move to be secure income. It can stay level throughout your retirement. But if it has any variability, right? I nailed it, right, Chris?
Variability.
That's what I said. Whatever. There's no movement except upwards. And it's like a ratchet set. For those of you who ever work with tools and you have a ratchet set, it moves, but it only moves in one direction. You can't go backwards. That's the whole idea of the ratchet set. So if secure income moves at all, it ratchets up only. It cannot go back down. And number three, and this is what rules out a lot of your VG ideas. Number three, secure income is not backed by your assets. It's backed by a deep-pocketed third party that is practicing risk pooling. I kind of threw that last part in. It never was in my original definition, but people couldn't understand. So I added risk pooling. It's essentially a third party is responsible for those payments, not your assets. Your assets can run out and those payments continue. Why? A third party is responsible for promising them for the rest of your life, no matter how long you live.
It probably goes without saying, but I would probably reinforce a reliable third party.
True. Especially when it comes to pensions and annuities.
Yeah.
So if you stop and think about it, folks, there's only three sources of income that meet all of my requirements. The big one, and the one that Chris is the most knowledgeable person that I personally know of, is Social Security. And when Chris started working with me and I started explaining to him conceptually this, he didn't know anything about Social Security. But I shared with him that secure income is so important. I know annuities. I don't need you to learn annuities. I need you to learn Social Security. And to his credit, he did. Is he perfect? No, I don't think anybody is. But as any longtime listener to this podcast know, he knows Social Security. He's read the palms. He has an understanding of it. Because we feel Social Security is the single best form of secure income. Social Security is often maligned, but it is a wonderful source of lifetime secure income. And a lot of people poo-poo Social Security and say, oh, it's so small of a benefit relative to what I earn throughout my life. It's nothing to write home about. Some of you feel that way. And many of you listening to this podcast, that's true. Relative to what you were earning, Social Security doesn't seem like much. But for the vast majority of Americans, Social Security can be a significant, if not sole, source of their only form of income. And when you examine Social Security just in relation to minimum dignity floor expenses, you'll start to see it often covers most, if not all, of your minimum dignity floor expenses, at least at first. Chris will explain when he takes over why Social Security, why I said at least at first, and it generally has to do with the inflationary pressures, as he'll explain, and COLA adjustments of Social Security. Okay, so Social Security was the main form of income that met my definition of secure income. Then pensions obviously met it because they have all three of those elements. But not everyone has pensions anymore. They used to in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Even 60s and 70s, pensions, nearly every company had them, at least major employers, not mid-size and smaller companies didn't have them, but most major employers and most unions all had pension benefits. Sadly, it's gone the way of the dinosaur ever since Ted Banya. It was Ted, not Tom. Was it Tom or Ted? You just looked him up the other day, the father of the 401k. Ever since he came up with it, and I had his name last time. Tom. Okay. Ever since Tom Banya gave birth to the concept of the 401k in the early 80s.
No, it's Ted. It is Ted.
Is it Ted?
Okay. Oh, no, wait. Nope. Yeah, it's Ted, yeah.
Ted?
It is Ted. Ted Banya.
Ted. Yep. Ted Banya, not Tom. Ted. Ever since he created gave birth to them, he didn't create them. He just divined them from tax code section 401k. And the New York Times, as I said, did a front page business article on them. And then boom, 401ks took off. And companies were passing on pensions to you to manage by yourself. Not everybody has pensions anymore. So that's where the annuity steps in. And we're not going to get into annuities today. We will cover them as we always do in the month of June. Annuities are the single product you all love to hate, which is fine. I have no issue with you hating them. But we want to make sure you understand them. And when we say annuities, we are talking, for us, generally speaking, single premium immediate annuities. We're not talking the other type of popular annuity that we use quite regularly in our practice, multi-year guaranteed annuities or MIGAs. They're both annuities, but they're an apple and an orange. And it's kind of like a Chihuahua and a Great Dane are both dogs, but they're an apple and an orange. So right now we're just talking, for the most part in this series, single premium immediate annuities. I know there's a ton of other different annuities. We'll chat more about annuities in June. But income annuities share all three elements that I just described. Now, Chris is going to step in and explain the next phase, or step, if you will, that you have to do. You've got to project your secure income, overlay it, and you're going to discover two things. Perhaps a secure income shortage between retirement and when Social Security starts, and another shortage from Social Security until some unknown point in the future when you die, which could be the day after you created your Excel spreadsheet, or 40 years from then. I don't know. Neither do you, which creates some unique problems. So, Chris, why don't you just explain the overlay step? What do you do? What inflationary rates do you use? And how do you come up with the dollar amounts to project? Not the shortages. Let's just talk about the known income sources, Social Security, pension, and income annuity. Any advice you can give our listeners who might have one, two, or three of those sources of income, how do they figure out what to project?
Well, first, dealing with your Social Security, depending on your age and how close you are to retirement, the Social Security benefit estimate that you're provided directly from Social Security can be a good starting point. However, you need to make sure that the assumptions they're using in their estimate are consistent with your reality. What I mean by that is, with Social Security benefit estimates on the standard benefit statement, the dollar amount they're estimating at various ages is assuming that you continue to earn what you earned last year all the way up until claiming, which may or may not be true for you. And if you're really young, they're also making some interesting inflationary assumptions, which can cause the numbers to be a bit skewed. But if you're older than 60 and you've got a nice solid filled earnings record, then the estimate that they're giving you is probably pretty accurate. But there are some other tools you can use out on the internet. And then there's an advanced estimator tool directly from Social Security that allows you to customize some of the variables. But you're going to want to get a good estimate from Social Security so you know you're kind of going to build your secure income profile, if you will. And for many of you, Social Security is going to be the only estimate. Now, the estimate they're giving you is in today's dollars. If it's an estimate for turning on in the future, they're not making any kind of inflationary adjustments to it. So you're going to have to make inflationary adjustments to it because as you, if you followed our approach with the minimum dignity floor expenses, you inflated all of those. So the income sources need to be inflated at a reasonable rate. And I, in a recent podcast, actually, I talked about why we use the Social Security cost of living adjustment assumption of 2% per year, which we feel to be is conservative. Other people disagree, use a little bit higher. Some people use a bit lower, but that's what we use. You'd have to use whatever you're comfortable with. I wouldn't use a very high one, though. That would be inappropriate, in my opinion. But now you've got that, and Jim's describing a situation where you're kind of graphing these, so it's kind of nice. You can overlay them and have a clear visual picture of it. And you know, you're also going to get estimates if you have it for your pension. You'll have to likely request pension estimates for assumed retirement dates and what ages you might turn on. And you've got choices between you know, single life and joint life pensions with a survivorship option. And you'll have to investigate what options are available. And then once you've got your minimum dignity floor estimate, you'll probably have a better idea of what the secure income needs to do for you, which will, we reminded you last week too, that you need to make sure to do minimum dignity floor assumptions for both two of you alive, if you're a couple, and then also if only one of you is alive, because there will be differences in the minimum dignity floor, as there will be differences in the secure income. Your Social Security is likely to change when the first of you passes away, and your pension income might change when one of you passes away, or it might not, depends on the situation. A lot of pensions have no cost of living adjustments, so you're not going to have to worry about that. Even those that have cost of living adjustments, you need to make some reasonable assumptions about what that might be. Not all cost of living adjustments with pensions are contractually promised or guaranteed by any means. They could change in the future, and some are kind of up to the whims of a legislature in a state or some or a municipality that might randomly change their cost of living adjustments or randomly grant them or take them away if they've been doing them. So that's a little trickier. Right now, I think it's reasonable to assume that cost of living adjustments will continue for Social Security, but the pensions are a little bit more, you know, specific to your circumstances, and you'll have to use your best judgment in estimating those. And that's another layer of income. And if you already have some income annuities, you'll obviously need to have income estimates for that. Most people don't enter retirement already having those, but a few people do. And if you know you've already acquired some and it's going to be income now or in the future, you're going to need to estimate that along with any other, you know, variables, survivorship, cost of living adjustments, or they really have what we would consider a cost of living adjustment. It's usually some type of fixed inflation adjustment. But some are variable. They'll have a variable inflation adjustment, and you'll have to make your own assumptions about what's a reasonable thing to assume in that case. So now you've got your bag, might only be one, Social Security of secure income, and you're going to add that all up, and hopefully if you're, you know, following our advice, graphing it out and taking a look at it. And for people who don't start day one of retirement with all their secure income turned on, you're going to have what we call a delay period, a period where your secure income isn't fully on, isn't coming in to cover these minimum dignity floor expenses as a minimum, maybe more if you're lucky. But that early period is a little different than the post-delay period, which we define as the point at which your all of your secure income is turned on and will remain on for the rest of your life. That post-delay period is usually where I start because it's the most troublesome. And the reason I say that is the challenge with the post-delay period, the later period of life, is we don't know when it ends. And that's the key reason why we like to use secure income to protect the minimum dignity floor. We don't know when life ends for each individual. and we've got to cover these expenses, whether you have assets or not. Secure income, like Social Security, pensions, income annuities, if you have them, in our view, is a great partner, you know, the peanut butter to the jelly of the minimum dignity floor. They just are a great match because here's a resource that you can't outlive that's going to continue coming in that'll allow you to satisfy the minimum dignity floor expenses, which you won't outlive. They'll continue as long as you're around. And so we look at that, look at any possible shortages there. Some people, as Jim mentioned, once they turn on all their, even if it's just the Social Security, will initially see pretty good coverage, maybe even a little surplus above their minimum dignity floor early on. But then if you're using assumptions like we do, which is the minimum dignity floor expenses inflate faster than most secure income, including Social Security, eventually when one thing is inflating faster than the other, even if the, you know, the one starts ahead, the faster inflating of the two is going to eventually catch up to and surpass the lower inflation adjustment item. And the lower inflation adjustment item for us is the secure income itself. So that's why we constantly see, even for people that start out with good coverage, there's eventually what we call a crossover point, a point where there is a gap that starts to show up, a gap between your secure income and your minimum dignity floor projections. And it's that gap we want to plug with additional secure income. And we go through a, you know, variety of methods to estimate what that might be, and we can talk about that in a minute. But I want to talk about the other half, the first part, the delay period. It's that period where your gap is going to be more volatile, I'll call it, because there's a lot of things going on until things kind of settle into more of a steady state. The delay period also happens to be a period where there's a lot of transitionary events happening. Transitioning from, say, employer-based healthcare to the open market, and then eventually onto Medicare. You might be at the tail end of paying off some car loans or home loans, or there's just things that tend to be a little more choppy on the minimum dignity floor early on before things kind of settle in. And plus, early on, this early delay period, we have an advantage in funding it, in that we know when it ends. It ends when all the secure income is turned on. So we don't propose you immediately start day one of retirement necessarily with plenty of secure income to cover the minimum dignity floor. We admit that it's more practical and to us makes more sense to cover the early period with simple distributions. The reason why we're comfortable covering the delay period with simple distributions from assets is that when you start retirement, you still have all your assets. It's just a budgetary exercise. We just need to set aside enough to cover these expenses until the secure income is turned on. At that point, we may or may not need additional resources. That was kind of handled in the first part of the conversation. But the delay period, you just don't overthink it. It's just a matter of budgeting enough of your saved assets so that you know they have a job to cover the minimum dignity floor until the secure income turns on, maybe as late as 70 years old for some people if they're waiting that long to turn on Social Security. And then at that point, the secure income kind of takes over and carries the load, if you will, and deals with that point to mortality, whenever that day may be. But that's kind of how we put the pieces together, the minimum dignity floor, the different secure income sources. And then we look for, and I think you asked me not to talk about the gap, and I accidentally went a little too far and talked a bit about the gap, but we can talk now about, you know, how we might estimate the gap, particularly in the long term, and how we might apply our remedy to any gaps that show up.
Right. I think you adequately covered the delay period. Do you agree?
I think so. Well, I want to emphasize it, though, because a lot of people misunderstand and they ask us questions constantly about, I've got, you know, I need money for this delay period. What annuity do I need? Well, there's not really an income annuity solution for that. There might be a discussion about positioning assets in the delay period that an annuity might be part of that discussion. The MIGAs that Jim mentioned, or other CDs, cash, money market funds.
Well, we could chat a little because we've had people ask us this. We've had clients do mm-hmm. this. So let's look at the delay period, because again, folks, it's the easy one.
Yeah.
It has an end period. If we came with expiration dates, the post-delay period would also be equally easy.
Yeah, and I probably wouldn't be as attracted to annuitizing for additional secure income if you're kind enough to share with me the day you will pass. Because at that point, then it just becomes a math
problem. I don't
think
annuities would technically exist, at least in the sense that we know them, if we all came with known expiration dates. Because funding for a need with a known end date is easy. So your delay period MDF, let's look at that first. As you overlay this, what we do is for us, just so you can envision, we have a red bar graph that represents your minimum dignity floor. It goes from the lower left to the upper right, which it should. Secure minimum dignity floor needs constantly increase throughout retirement. The only variability in your spending, in my opinion, is with fun. But food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare pretty much continue. Yes, we get it. You're going to eat less food as you age. But for the most part, those five categories of expenses will constantly be there, never go away, and kind of trot along matching the lifestyle that you want to mirror in retirement. And increasing steadily at rates of inflation higher than general headline inflation. Pretty straightforward. I truly would, if I were you, then calculate what your secure income sources are. Social Security, pensions, and annuities, if you have one, two, or three of those. And overlay them. We do. We list, we click a little button and green bars will appear representing Social Security. And then, well, we have all, I don't know what other colors, I just know green is Social Security. I don't know what colors. I think you use purple for annuity and blue for pension, but the colors are immaterial,
right,
folks.
That's just the colors we use, yeah.
What we do is we break them out. We don't put all secure income in one bucket. We break them out by the types of secure income and when they're going to begin, again, for the visualization. So we can make sure as the numbers are being visualized for us, it makes sense based on what we programmed and what we expect to see. So if we see changes or see any anomaly that doesn't make sense, we can key on it quicker. We do it because we look at dozens of these a month. Easily. And if we were staring at dozens and dozens of these for clients and just numbers, we would miss things. So visualize it. When you do that, you're going to start to receive or determine right away two very important toys to remove from your toy box. And if you're a new listener, you're like, what the hell is this guy talking about? He went from retirement to toys? But if you're a longtime listener, you know the toy box is the euphemism I give your available retirement assets. The money you have, all pooled in one. We don't break it out. We technically do behind the scenes, but conceptually, whatever your money is. Now, we've used in the past $2.8 million, and I'm sticking with that because it just as a number we've used years ago, we came up with a hypothetical client, you got $2.8 million. So let's just say you do have $2.8 million. Ultimately, you're going to do this minimum dignity floor secure income calculation because you know in order to find buried inside that toy box of yours, the one toy that you really want, which we call your fun number, how much of that $2.8 million can you spend on fun? That's what you want to know. Because we believe you should spend it on fun sooner rather than later. that leaving the fund number buried inside your portfolio, buried inside the toy box, if you're going to keep the lid of your toy box closed and it's made out of solid pine, stained brown like mine was as a kid growing up, and you don't know what the hell you got in the toy box, what good is that? That's what retirement is if you're entering it with just one big portfolio. Get away from the mindset of an accumulation saver and into the mindset of a distribution spender. Retirement is the mirror opposite. It is that Seinfeld episode of George Costanza. We're going to do another show on the opposite. Just if anything, to play the snippet from Seinfeld again, where Jerry points out to George, maybe doing the opposite will work for you because doing what you've been doing hasn't worked for you. And it worked brilliantly for George, at least at the start of that particular year, when he picked up a really hot blonde and got a job with the New York Yankees, because he did the opposite of everything he would normally do. Retirement is the opposite. So rather than just having one big ass portfolio broken out at 60-40, 70-30, 80-20, 90-10, whatever risk level of stocks, bonds, and cash you wanted, that worked during the accumulation period. It doesn't work in the decumulation period. But buried in that 2.8 million is your fund number. How are you going to find it? Well, you got to pull out all the toys first associated with the minimum dignity floor, because that takes precedence. What you are doing is an explicit promise to the older you that the money that they will need to take care of their food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses will be there for them. So this is the first two toys or dollar amounts you have to pull out of your toy box or your portfolio. And that is the delay period shortage and the post-delay period shortage. Once you figure out your MDF and your secure income and you overlay the two of them, you can visually see it. It's brilliant. People love it. There it is. We're going to quantify these numbers for you in a minute, but here is your where your delay period ends. Here's where you're 70. Everything to the left of this, this is your delay period. All this red that's showing after all the colors of your secure income are added in there, that's your MDF shortage. That's what you need. We're going to quantify the dollar amount for you. Chris is going to explain in a minute how you do that. That one's easy. Then to the right, it's usually age 70. To the right of age 70, that's the part of the bar graph that goes on into infinity. Not technically true infinity, but infinity for you. Because to me, when you die, your infinity has ended. You're dead. But you don't know how much to the right of age 70 those bars are going to go. We convey to 93, not because we feel all our clients will be dead at 93. Many of you, if you're listening to our clients, or many of you non-clients listening, many of you will be alive post-93. Why? Your upper, middle class, and higher, if you're listening to this, for the most part, you've amassed decent amount of wealth, where 2.8 million might be on the target of what you have amassed for your retirement. And generally, those people have better health care and take better care of themselves than, sadly, other people in society whose deaths earlier in life pull down the life expectancy of the group, but not necessarily the life expectancy of upper middle class Americans. So you have a very good chance of being alive after 93. I was just speaking the other day about my dad to a friend of mine who was over my house as I was gardening. And we were talking about my dad and how he spent the last year of his life in the nursing home. And I mentioned that he passed at 89. And I also mentioned to them that one of the things that I found amazing when I went and visited him was a friend he had made. I can't remember the woman's name, but I've talked about her on the podcast, folks. My dad was in a wheelchair. I'm walking next to him. A nurse was pushing the wheelchair. Next to the nurse was my father's wife. My parents are divorced. My dad had remarried. And next to the wife was a woman in a walker who was walking with the wife, chatting with her. Doreen was the wife's name. That woman, my dad was telling me, was a good dancer, son. And I'm looking at this elderly woman thinking, mm-hmm. She was 105. Now, she didn't dance without the walker. But apparently, they would have a dance every Friday or every other Friday, I forget, where they would play music. And she would be out on the dance floor with her walker, kind of rocking back and forth and moving the walker around. My dad is being wheeled at 89 in a wheelchair. A 105-year-old woman is walking on her own with the aid of a walker, yes, but not a human pushing her in a wheelchair. She is the other guy. Now, it's nice to think that's not going to be me. It's going to be someone else who'll live to 105 and still be around. But we don't know. When we look to the right of age 70, which is when most people's delay period ends, I don't know how many bars. Is there going to be 35 bars and maybe 36, 37, 38? I don't know. Is there going to be 2 bars, 1 bar, 20 bars? I don't know. And that's what makes figuring out that number difficult. But we need both those numbers so you can then go to your toy box, pull those dollars out. I don't mean literally if they're in an account, you have to physically move them and put them in a separate account. But you have to mentally account for them differently and invest them differently. So, Chris, did you do a good enough job, you think? Because someone might not have been at his computer the entire time you were talking. Did you do a good enough job to explain how you quantify the delay period number, or do you want to add a little info on that?
I think I gave the essence of it, but it's not, again, don't overthink it. It's the sum of all of the minimum dignity floor expenses that you need to cover during the delay period, less any secure income that you might have coming in. And there's other things. I think the delay period also is some nuances. If someone has some deferred comp, which we didn't list as a secure income source, but that's pretty reliable. Some people might have some part-time work if they judged that it was reliable, that they could count on it, and they wouldn't suddenly be let go, although nothing's for sure. But you could technically count some income like that to cover during the delay period. So there's some kind of not technically secure income sources that would maybe be reasonable resources to offset. But anything that's left that you're going to rely on your assets to distribute to cover, you need to carve those off and reserve those and earmark them, label them. Here's my minimum dignity floor support during the delay period. It's pretty much that straightforward.
Now, there's a lot of other nuances that we could dive into, and this series will go months. So I'm not going to dive hugely deep into it, but if there's... We will try to chat about this deeper on future shows. But what do you do with that toy? You just identified it. You've got the dollar amount. You've quantified it. Now, do keep in mind, the way we do it, it's an inflation-adjusted dollar amount already. We're growing that amount by what we feel are reasonable estimates of an annualized rate of inflation, not the rate in any given year, but annualized over your lifetime. It's as accurate as we can be without a crystal ball. Same thing with your secure income. You've projected reasonable COLA adjustments to Social Security. Annuities and pensions are a lot easier because few of them have true cost of living adjustments. Most pensions don't, unless you have a government one. And annuities, if they come with any type of increase, will be a stated increase, which makes the calculation very easy. We're going to increase it 2, 2.5, 3, 3.5, 4, 4.5, 5% per year, whatever the case may be. Or it's going to be a level flat. It's your choice as you buy the annuity. So it's once you get that number, that dollar amount, that toy, you're going to go to your toy box and isolate those dollars. You're going to be removing those dollars. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, to keep everything round, and Chris, write this down for me so in the future we'll know what it is. You started with $2.8 million. Let's just say your secure income shortage during the delay period is $800,000. So I can make this real simple. Your toy box is now down to $2 million. But you have what the delay period is. Now, that example, we have seen people with delay periods that big. In hindsight, Chris, I'm going to make this a little more realistic to what we normally see.
If you had, a seven-year delay period, it's certainly possible it could be that big.
Okay, we'll leave it at 800. We've seen some in the millions, low millions, but we've seen it. 800,000, just conceptually follow along. Please spare me the angry emails if you don't have 2.8 million or if you have way more than 2.8 million asking me, why didn't you use a bigger number? Why didn't you use a smaller number? It doesn't matter the number. Conceptually follow what I'm explaining. So your toy box has gone from 2.8 to 2. You still haven't found the fun toy yet. You're still looking for that fun number. You're not there yet. But you got one of the toys out of the toy box, and it was a pretty easy calculation to make. Now you might be thinking, but goodness, Jim, I don't know if I'm going to be that 105-year-old woman dancing, or if I'm going to be the sad person who dies within a year of retirement. How the hell do I figure the next shortage? And that shortage, Jim, because I visualized it the way you said and I'm looking at it, man, does it start to grow? It was kind of minimal at first. When I did my calculations, the back of an envelope, it looked really good at 69, 70, 72. But God, as I look at this and it gets out into the 78, 80, 83, this shortage is growing at 85, 88, my God, and 90, 92, 95. This thing is flying. How the heck do I figure out that number? I don't know if I'm the 105-year-old dancing or the person who sadly died in year one of retirement. Well, it's not hard to solve for that number either, folks. And it's not hard to find the next toy. What you're going to do is you're actually going to use the companies supplying the products you VGs love to hate. You're going to go to the insurance companies and you're going to ask them. Now, you're not going to call them because they're going to tell you diddly squat. But everywhere, it's online. And here's how Chris and I handled this. We figured, who better to know than the actuaries of insurance companies to figure out how much it's going to cost to protect this unknown? The unknown being, are you going to be 105 years old dancing every other Friday in a nursing home? Or are you going to be dead within a year of retirement? Insurance companies, they don't know if you're going to be the 105-year-old or the person who dies in year one. But Chris, does the insurance company care that they don't know?
No, because they're not dealing with just you. They're dealing with hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of others like you. And for their math to work out, they just have to have a good estimate about how on average how long everyone's going to live. And that data is readily available to them. That's something that is kind of eerily unknown figure. When you're dealing with large populations of humans, the insurance company actuaries can come eerily close each year in their estimate of how many people in that pool will have passed away. So they essentially take an unmanageable, unknown risk and make it known for them. They know the risk they have to plan for, and they can then price their products appropriately, which then allows you to have a known value you need to fund, because you have the option of joining that group. You can take your individual situation, which has a completely unknown end date, and you can say, I want to trade in my individual unknown end date and replace it for planning purposes with a known end date, which would allow me to fund it more directly and easily. And that's essentially what you're doing when you join the pool, when you look into the pricing of and eventually maybe buy an income annuity. You're joining that pool and handing over a fixed sum of money. There's how you take an unknown and make it known. You now know how much you had to hand over to generate lifetime income as long as you live, no matter how long that might be. And so it's kind of a, you know, it's risk pooling and offloading the risk to this insurance company is what it's all about. And what the risk we're concerned about is longevity risk. We're financially, you know, as rude as it might sound, it's a blessing to pass away early. That's a financial blessing. It's horrific every other way, but financially, that's a blessing. What we're concerned about financially is outliving your assets, living too long. And unless you have an enormous amount of assets, there's a potential out there. There's a risk that you'll run out. If you have enough, then you just naturally have little risk of that happening. But for most people we work with and deal with, and most people listening to this, I mean, if you had so much money you're never going to run out, I'm not sure this show is all that exciting to you. But if you have enough to retire, but you still have this potential risk out there, well, I think then it makes sense. It makes sense to deal with this one risk of all the many risks in retirement, but at least greatly reduce or eliminate, if possible, this longevity risk piece. And that's what happens with the annuity.
Right. That's how we calculate. Now, you can calculate it other ways. You can base it on the safe withdrawal rate. You can base it off of your own assumptions of growth and what you're going to earn and all this other stuff. We're not disputing there's other ways of doing this.
True.
But to us, because we do believe passionately for all the reasons we have listed in covering the right part of this graph from age 70 out to the right, with lifetime guaranteed secure income, even for people with more than enough money that they're not going to outlive it, I still have to quantify that toy. I've got to find another toy and get it out of the toy box, because the toy you want, like a kid, when you were a 10-year-old going to your toy box, invariably the toy you wanted was at the bottom of the damn toy box. Your fun number is at the bottom of your portfolio. Your portfolio is no longer an asset, folks. Your portfolio is just a big pot. And I don't mean pot in the Colorado sense anymore, but a big pot of like soup or something. And you just want to know how much of that soup can I eat for fun? You just want to identify that fun pot of your portfolio. Well, in order to do it, I got to remove all the other soup that doesn't apply to fun. It applies to other spending. Your money is deferred spending. It's no longer an investment. It's no longer an asset. If you don't spend it, someone else will. And we jokingly say, if you don't fly first class, someone else will. And how are you going to figure out if you can afford that first class ticket or not? Well, you got to figure out how much you can spend on fun. In order to do that, you got to quantify the unknown. Chris was correct in this. That's why we do it this way. I have to quantify something I don't know. I don't know if you're going to be dead within 1 year or 105 and dancing in a nursing home. I don't know. And it's easy for you to say, well, that's not going to be me. You could be the other guy someday. You just don't know. I don't think this 105-year-old woman in 1889, when she, not 1889, I was trying to do the math in my head. She was born when, Chris, if she's 105?
1919.
1919 would be 105. Okay. When she was born in 1919, I don't think she would have been able to say, well, not at 1 year old is she going to be able to say anything, but I don't think her parents in 1920 at her 1 year old birthday would ever imagine she would be dancing in a nursing home in the year 2024. Nobody knows. So what we do is we rely on insurance companies to give us the answer. How do we do that? Well, Chris then will start to look at the graph. You will look at your graph. I'm assuming you bar graphed it. You will start to see normally, initially at age 70, when the husband, wife, or single person, whatever the heck your situation is, you'll see initially most or all of your minimum dignity floor needs may be covered with your Social Security, especially if you're a couple situation. But eventually a shortage will appear. You'll see this in your graph. We call that the crossover point. Anecdotally, for most people, it's between 78 and 83, that five-year window. When that crossover point happens and we can see it, it tells us, okay, we looks to us like the crossover point might be, let's just say, age 80. It appears about age 80 is where the shortage begins. Now, your shortage could begin much sooner or be projected to never appear. Everyone is different. So if you're doing this on your own and your shortage appears at age 72, don't think you're doing something wrong. It's just maybe you're a single person and you don't have a very big Social Security benefit. I don't know. So in my hypothetical example, I'm just saying it begins at age 80. What Chris begins to do at this point, I'll let him explain a little bit more, but conceptually, he tries to see what that shortage is, but more importantly, at what rate of growth that shortage is on average achieving. And he can do it with calculating the numbers. He can see the shortage. We see it on the graph. He's not out there measuring it with a measuring tape. He's going back and pulling the data numbers, and he's seeing the growth rate of this shortage. He knows what the shortage starts at, and he knows what the average growth rate of that shortage is. Now, the next step gets a little bit more complicated, unfortunately, because in the past, we had access to one insurance company in particular, New York Life, a company that I do admire a lot for lifetime guaranteed income, would offer people a lifetime annuity payment with an annual increase anywhere between 1 and 10% or zero. You didn't have to get one with an annual increase, but you could go between 1 and 10% a year. Most people did not have a growth rate on their shortage in excess of 10%. Unfortunately, from what we can see, and we asked if there was a New York Life agent ever listening, if they could explain or if New York Life ever told them why they got rid of that and now have COLA adjustments only between 1% and 4%. I don't know. Chris and I hypothesized between the two of us various reasons. The one that rose to the top the most was maybe they just didn't sell enough beyond 4% because it was expensive. The more of a COLA adjustment you needed, the more expensive the annuity became. Maybe they just didn't sell enough and there wasn't enough pool members in there to risk pool. And from an actuarial standpoint, they didn't have enough subjects and they felt uncomfortable making those guarantees. That's the likely scenario that we could think of for them to get rid of this. But There are other companies that do offer. I think you can get up to what now, Chris? A 6 or 6.5 with a few companies?
You can go up to 8 now.
8 now. Mm-hmm. So we don't name the companies, except I do talk about New York Life. But and we don't start, I'm not licensed with them or anything. It's just people have always asked, who do you generally use? We like New York Life, but there's many, many equally strong companies. Okay. So now we at least have the ability, if the cost of living adjustment is within 1-8% a year on a growth rate, we go to a service that we have access to called Canix, which you will not have access to, but there are many websites out there that offer annuity quotes. In the background powering it is Canix. So they're using it, even though you don't have access to it directly. But you would go and you would say, let's just say the shortage begins at age 80. So you would tell the software, the website that you go to for a annuity quote, that you are 80 now. And you, let's just say your shortage started at an average of $10,000 a year was your shortage, estimated $10,000 a year. Remember, because you're using inflation-adjusted minimum dignity floor numbers, that's how much you want. That's the nominal amount you want at first. It's going to be increased for inflation after that. But you want $10,000 at age 80. So you tell the software you're already 80. Now, if you've done this calculation, you should have done it for survivorship as well. And same calculation, but you're going to put one of you passing away early. We use age 70 or 5 years into retirement. And there's a reason behind that. We didn't randomly choose it. We wanted an age where a lot of your fund spending was already done. So your portfolio was taxed already, was spent down. Dying on day one of retirement is easy. The survivor has all their money. Dying at 93 is easy because you've made it that long. There's not much more your survivor is going to live unless your survivor was 20 years younger than you. But dying at 70, we felt if somebody retired at 60, 62, 63, 64, 65 even, a good amount of their fun go-go spending has already happened. Now, we say 5 years or 70, whatever is longer, because if you retire at 70, we don't want to kill you off right at 70. We want to create a worst case scenario, if you will, and that is 5 years of good fun spending, even at 70. So that's why we say 5 years of retirement or age 70, whatever is longer, is where your death begins. So you're going to have to do the same calculation by killing off the husband, killing off the wife, or spouse one, spouse two, whatever you want to call them, removing the Social Security down to the survivorship, removing any pension benefits that are lost at the death of each person, removing any annuity benefits that might be lost at the death of each person, and projecting what the survivor is going to look like. Don't forget to do that step as well. There's three calculations you're doing for the couple, as the widow and the widower. Then you're going to also figure out the income shortages that the widow or widower may be faced with. More likely than not, whatever you do to fix the income shortage for the couple will be enough to protect the widow-widower, but not all the time. And we sometimes see that the dollar amount to protect the couple is less than what would happen if one of them died early. So we will often have them reserve those dollars as well. So back now to the annuity quote, and what are you going to do with that? In my example, I said age 80 is the shortage. It's $10,000 a year. And let's say you estimate it to be growing at 5% a year. Keeping this real simple, but conceptually follow along. So you will go to your annuity quote software, whether you're at immediateannuities.com or the any other dozens that are out there for retail investors, and you're going to tell them your sex, you're going to tell them the date of birth you have, you're going to tell them if you want joint income that will continue for the spouse, and if so, what's the spouse sex and what's the spouse's date of birth. You're also going to tell them the state you live in. Don't make a state up. They're going to base it on your state and if your state is charging any premium taxes or not, because that's going to premium taxes, for those who don't know, are taxes some states place on premiums going into an annuity. They tax it. So if you have a premium tax, the insurance company is not going to eat that and pay it on your behalf. So your annuity costs will be higher than a state that doesn't charge a premium tax. So you have to put your home state in there, joint and survivor or not, husband, wife, all that information. Then you're going to tell them, what would an 80-year-old need if to put in if their shortage was $10,000 a year, and I want the income beginning immediately, and it was rising at 5% a year. Once you hit calculate, you'll receive a bunch of different quotes. Depending on what website you go to and what insurance companies they represent, you could have two or three quotes, or you might have a dozen quotes. I don't know. Not every annuity is going to offer the 5% adjustment, so annuities that don't offer that won't even be quoted, but you'll end up getting some ideas of what an insurance company would want at age 80. But you're only 65. You're not 80 yet. Let's just say hypothetically you're 65-year-old retiree. And let's just say that dollar amount comes to $800,000. It's probably bigger than what it would ever be, but let's just say $800,000. Well, you're only 65. Do you need to put $800,000 off to the side? No. What we do is we then discount that down. We use a 3% discount rate, which put in English for some of you, it means we're going to assume you're going to put a dollar amount aside today. We're going to assume that for the next 15 years, it grows at 3%. So when you're 80, you will have $800,000. So that's how we figure out how much to pull out of your toy box for this second number. Now, there's one caveat to remember. This number is based on risk pooling. If you don't have any intention of ever buying an income annuity, and if you're 65, it's not your damn decision. You have no right making the decision for the 80-year-old that they will not buy an income annuity. I'm not going to let them. Well, I got news for you. 65-year-old you ain't going to be around when 80-year-old you is figuring it out. 80-year-old you is going to make that decision. And you may loathe and despise and hate income annuities right now. 80-year-old you, he or she may actually like them. But your job is to make sure those dollars are reserved for 80-year-old you. Did I miss anything in this explanation, Chris?
No, that's essentially what we look at. We've got to estimate the gap, look at the gap growth over time, which it, in the way we approach things with our assumptions of inflation for the income and the expenses, the gap when it appears always grows over time. We can solve for that growth rate looking at the numbers. Those of you with spreadsheets easily could estimate that. You now, the goal is to fund, create additional income to pile on top of your Social Security or pension or whatever else you have to start with, such that you can confidently say the minimum dignity floor looks to be covered for the rest of my life, both as a couple or as an individual survivor. You've got the numbers then, and now you know what annuity income would be needed to satisfy that goal of covering that gap, and you just pull a quote, and then you do the proper adjustments to essentially arrive at a number that relates to the toy box. How much do I need to reserve today so I'm confident the older me would be able to annuitize for additional secure income if they decide they still want it or want it at the time? How much do I need to set aside today? And that's the whole goal of the exercise, is to figure out how much of that toy box we need to pull out and say, you can't touch that for fun. That is for protecting the long-term minimum dignity floor. Off limits. Just like the first toy we pulled out. This is for minimum dignity floor during the delay period. You can't spend that on fun. It's off limits. Hands off. It's the first two toys we pull out of the box as we search around and rummage around for that fun number, which is where we're headed over the next few shows. And we'll talk, I'm assuming, in the next show about how we identify the other toys that need to be pulled out of the box before we get to that fun number, right?
That's going to be on the next show. We're going to identify that next amount. And also, Chris will run the calculations if you're following along, because we started with 2.8 million. We said 800,000 needed to be reserved for, in our hypothesis, this is not based on any client, but we had to reserve 800,000 for the delay period for this particular hypothetical scenario we're describing. Well, we also have to now discount down. And did we up it to 3.5 on the discount rate, or did we keep it at 3? I can't remember.
We've been traditionally using 3.
So 800,000 discounted down at 3% for 15 years.
200,000.
So we have to put 200,000 aside. Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
So you're started with 2.8 million. We subtracted 800,000 for the delay period. Now, this calculation that I just did, hypothetical calculation, but follow the concept, 800,000 is needed at age 80.
Sorry.
So
500,000. I typed the wrong digit on my calculator.
Okay. I thought that seemed awfully low.
It seemed a little low. 500,000 is the number.
So we ultimately want 800,000 at age 80. We're discounting it down 3. You can use any discount rate you want. You all know, you're smart BGs. You raise your discount rate, it's going to be a smaller dollar amount you have to pull out of your toy box. By default, leaving more toy inside your toy box that might go to your fund. You use a smaller discount rate, you're going to have to put more aside, leaving you less money in your toy box, or ultimately less money for fun. So this again is a decision you have to make. We use 3. We think it's fair. We think it's reasonable. We also know and tell our clients, you're probably going to earn significantly more than 3. We're not telling you to take this reserve out. It's a 15-year hold. That's a long-term hold. I don't care if you invested 100% in equities. I truly don't. Because I don't care if it falls right away. If it fell in year one, 50%, it would suck emotionally. But if this is money you're spending in 15 years, 80-year-old, you ain't going to care. They're going to be saying, damn, their timing was terrible. But it's a 15-year hold. We generally tell people you're going to invest this toy based on your risk tolerance, at least until you get about 7 or 8 years from needing it. Then you're going to start changing it. But in my hypothetical, it's 15 years. You probably will earn more than the 3% discount rate. But think this through, folks. You could use a larger discount rate if you want, giving yourself more money for fun. But if things don't quite work out, you just screwed the older you. I've always said the younger you has to give an explicit promise to the older you. Your MDF is taken care of. In return, you will get permission from the older you to spend money on fun early. Don't screw the older you by saying, I want to spend more money on fun, so I'm going to assume an 8% discount rate. I'm only going to put $100,000, $150,000 aside, or whatever that comes to, and magically grow the amount of toy remaining in that toy box. Use a rate that you feel is fair to the older you. And here's the thing. Even if you earn more than 3, it will bleed down to fun eventually. Because we tell people you should be updating these numbers on a regular basis. Maybe every 3 to 5 years. Occasionally we tell people you don't need to update. But for the most part, we say every 3 to 5 years, look at these numbers again. Look at your shortage. Make sure the MDF calculations are accurate. Make sure the discount is coming in. In other words, get the annuity quote again in 3 to 5 years and see, are you on track to having that much money? Keep monitoring this. It's not a set it and forget it. And if you do earn more than three, and most of you will, especially with a 15 years in my hypothetical example, we would have some or all of that money invested for growth. It's going to be up to the client's risk tolerance, obviously, folks. But chances of it earning more than three are good, not in any given year. So we feel it's going to be growing. If we can show people in the future that, hey, you've got much more than you need, now you have an idea, well, I'm going to keep it in there. I'm going to let the older me have it. Or, hey, wow, we're $75,000. I'm making this up, but we're $75,000 more than what the new update and the new annuity quote is showing we need. Yeah, let's take that $75,000 and push it down to fun. That's going to be a decision you make at the time. Just don't think that this is a set it and forget it. You have to monitor this and be careful with the discount rate. Just because we use three doesn't mean you have to. But you've got to promise the older you that you have used a fair discount rate. Okay, I know we have to wrap up because I've got a lot to do. I will be traveling, folks. By the time you hear this, I will most likely be in Indianapolis. And next week, I will be in Florida. I'm going to try to do the EDU show with Chris, recorded from my hotel room in Florida on my iPad. So this is going to be an interesting little trip to see if we can pull this one off. But hopefully you will hear Chris and I again next week, continuing this series.
Yep, sounds good. So next week will be part four of, again, an unknown number. We'll take as many parts as it requires to go through the whole process. So you get a total view of our approach and the way we think, if you will. But we really appreciate everyone listening. If you've got questions about any element that you're hearing, suggestions, your own version of how we do it, this is a kind of a blended dialogue series as well, which means we're open to, in real time as we do these shows, bringing up people's emails as they're contributing their thoughts to what we've been talking about on the show. If you want to send in your own dialogue input, send it to Jim directly. jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. Make sure in the subject line you indicate that it's feedback for the podcast or something related to the podcast will catch his eye. Stay tuned next week for part four. And Jim, safe travels. And everyone will be back next week, one way or another, with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jim@jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.